Stephanie.
And I'm Joel.
And this is Sunday School Cinema. Hooray!
We're actually back after 2 weeks, which I don't know when the last time that happened was that we actually recorded two episodes 2 weeks apart, which is theoretically our schedule.
It's been a minute, but you know, life happens. It is what it is. And you know, when we run out of movies on this one, we're going to have to come up with a new plan. So, you know, this puts that off.
That's true. We're just dragging this out so we don't have to strategize.
So today we are talking about the 2004 movie that I don't think I've heard anyone talking about in many years, Mean Creek.
Yeah, it's I don't know that anyone really remembers this movie, although it has a couple faces in it that people would know, and I think it was pretty well received at the time, even you know as a pretty small indie movie, but I think it was pretty well regarded, but it seems to have been mostly forgotten.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, it's a movie that I was really into at the time, and I can see why. I don't dislike it now. I think I liked it more then. I think at this point, and this has happened with a few of the movies that we've watched, that it feels like when I watch it, it feels really like a, like to some extent, sort of a part and parcel of this whole like independent film in this era sort of thing.
It does feel very of its time. I think it's a really solid movie, but it does definitely it's like sort of like early digital where like low budget stuff could just kind of go out, you know, into the woods with a small group of people and shoot a movie or whatever. I think this one is better made than a lot of those are, but it is very it does seem very of the time.
Yeah, I think that what stood out to me watching it at this point is that I think, and we talked about this a little bit, I think with like The Believer, which is from a very, if not the same year, within a couple of years, that I think a lot of the film techniques are not particularly interesting, or they just feel like all sort of like similar to a lot of other things I saw. But I do think that there's a skill in the social dynamics in this, and the kids are just incredible.
Yeah, the performances are uniformly great, and I do think they're... I'm curious how much of it was, you know, if they did a lot of, like, sort of coming up with stuff as they went, which I feel like is kind of... That's not an uncommon story for this type of shoot where a group of people go out into the woods to make a movie, right? They end up kind of improvising stuff or coming up with it in rehearsal or whatever, but it may have all been written, too, which, if that's the case, it's also very impressive. Like, I do think there's a lot of... I mean what's the bully character's name again?
George.
Right, George is like a very. I feel like everyone has known a George or two, or been a George at some point in their life, and like the way he responds to everything, and the way everyone responds to him, and like, you know, the people who are just sick of him and not interested in being around him, and the people who are like trying to be nice because they think that he'll come around if they're nice enough to him. And like, it's all very, it all feels very realistic to me, at least.
No, I agree. I think that the mix of like sort of frustration and pity that the kids treat him with is like something that is really familiar to me. I know that when Morgan watched it, they felt like they had been a little bit more on George's side of things. Not so mean, but like, whereas I
feel like I had a little bit of that. I mean, there's one part in particular where George actually like manages to get a laugh out of everyone. Like, even though everyone has been mad and annoyed at him, and he realizes that, he does a thing that gets everyone on his side for a minute. And then he gets like so excited about that he just pushes way too far and fucks it all up. And I feel like I, not to that extreme, but I feel like I remember being that person when I was younger, like just not, you know, getting overexcited about having the people that you're looking up to all of a sudden laughing along with you instead of at you, and just like pushing it way too far, and the tide turns right back on you.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say age dynamics are a big part in this, but like, let's... So the movie is about, like, Rory Culkin is probably the most recognizable name in the movie. He was like 15 or 16 when it came out, but it was filmed earlier, so I think he was probably like 13 or 14.
And the Culkins always, when they were kids in particular, they all looked younger than they were. He looks about, I think he's supposed to be 11 or 12 maybe, and he looks about that.
Yeah. Yeah, they're all very tiny waif-like children, but now kind of tiny waif-like adults. But he gets beaten up by George, who has been held back a couple of grades. So George is old enough that he should be in junior high, but has been held back. And so,
right, and that's part of the thing. So the older brother of Rory was Sam. Also knows this kid because they were also in grade school together. Like, he would have been older, but like, so there's like weird crossover that only exists because this kid is like this troubled kid who's been held back at least a couple years.
Yeah. And of course he also is much physically bigger than the other kids. And of course doesn't have a lot of friends because of reasons that I think we can all probably intuit, given the information we've just given. And he beats Rory up, Sam up at some point. And, because Sam, like, he sets up his camera to like film himself shooting a basket, and Sam, I think, like, is curious about the camera or wonders what it is.
Yeah, we don't really know, because that's the opening of the movie is the kid setting up it's the shot from the camera, the kid setting up the camera, and then Sam coming around and picking it up. So we don't really know exactly what Sam was thinking, if he just saw it sitting there and didn't know. That's kind of my assumption, because he knows this kid is a bully, and it doesn't seem like he would fuck with him intentionally at this point. So I assume he just saw the camera sitting there and went to pick it up to see what the deal was. But the kid freaked out and beats him up.
Yeah, and you know, and he's got some bruising and scrapes and stuff. Like, he's overall okay, but obviously it was a scary situation. And his older brother is very much like, you know, we gotta do something. Like,
right, this kid's been a bully for years, and he just keeps getting away with it. And you know, someone should do something about it.
So the older brother hangs out with these other couple of kids. And again, I cannot overstate the level to which I felt like I knew all of these kids at some point. Like, I have met all of these kids. I have been some of these kids. I have, like, and it really feels so naturalistic. And so, like, the dynamics between, you know, the older kids and the younger kids, the dynamics in each of the groups. Rory has a crush on this little girl. I can't remember her name. Like, she has this adorable...
Millie is her name.
Yeah. Millie. Which,
honestly, that whole thing is very cute. Like, they clearly really like each other, and they're like, planning to go on, like, their first date or whatever, and it's all very sweet.
It's extremely adorable. There's a scene of Millie carefully writing down questions to ask Sam on their date, which include, like, the wildest assortment of things.
Right, and then we see her trying to ask some of them, and he's just like, what? What are you talking about? It's very sweet.
It is very cute. And, like, you know, they're just at that age where, like, you know, they like each other and they're curious about things and whatever. And it all feels, like, pretty sweet and innocent. But there's this undercurrent of, like, you know, this kid is a danger. And then these older kids who are, and let's be clear, I think this is a big part of it, are bored. They, you know, I mean, I'm guessing they're 16, 17, somewhere in there.
Yeah, I think they're supposed to be like 16 to 18 probably, and you know, they live in this tiny little town where there's nothing much to do, and they're all kind of poor. It doesn't really get into that a whole lot, but it's clearly like none of them are wealthy people, and in fact I think that's part, like, it seems like George's family is probably much better off than the rest of them, which is also a factor here, and he kind of looks down on them for that, and they all kind of resent him for that. I think
George and also the kid who has the two gay dads, I think they seem slightly better off as well.
What was his name?
I can't remember his name. That's like his defining character.
Clyde. His name, yeah.
And so Clyde. So it's Clyde. Shit. What are the older kids' names? Clyde.
Okay, I got the letterbox pulled up right here. So we have Marty, who is the sort of oldest, the leader of the pack, played by a guy named Scott Meklowicz. Meklowicz, it's one of those CZ names. And then we have Rocky, who is Sam's older brother, played by Trevor Morgan, and Clyde, played by Ryan Kelly.
So you've sort of got these three older kids, and again, Marty, it seems like, is probably close to 18 or getting, like, he's clearly the older one. He's clearly got shit going on. We find out some of that over time. We see a lot of, like, you know, we see over throughout the movie, like, his brother is extremely bullying to him. There's, like, you know, there's a lot of, like, violence happening that is sort of being kicked downstream. But, like, he's, you know, I get it. Like, I've known Marty's, like, he's attractive, particularly for the time. He's really, like, the ideal.
He definitely has that, like, sort of, teen magazine cover look. Yeah.
He really does. And so he's attractive. He can be very funny and charming. He can, like, and he doesn't, I think, to the boys most of the time, like, they don't seem, the other boys don't seem afraid of him, which I thought was really smart, because I think a lot of times when you see these dynamics, the other one is the sort of leader of the pack is the one that everyone's afraid of, and he's being super mean to them. But that's really not how it plays out here most of the time. Like, he is, like, you know, yeah, they're, like, hitting each other and, like, that sort of shit, but none of them seem, like, particularly not Rocky, doesn't seem, like, afraid that he's gonna do anything actually. He's just, like, he's just an asshole sometimes, like, and I think that's much more realistic to how these groups often work.
Yeah, and I, you know, it doesn't really go into it, but you clearly get the impression that, like, they've probably known each other since they were five. They've been hanging out all this time, whatever. They know what his issues are, and they, you know, they, he goes too far sometimes, but they all get it, and, you know, it's fine.
And there, and, like, he in particular is super shitty to Clyde. Like, it, I mean, like, you assume that these kids must have known each other growing up, because otherwise it's really unclear why Clyde would hang out with them, because they are both kind of assholes to him about it. But, like, clearly Marty about his dad's being gay and calling him a lot of language that was very, you know, R slur, F slur, like, a lot of that sort of stuff that was very, that feels very grounded in this space.
Yeah, no, it totally makes sense in this movie. Like, it doesn't, sometimes you watch movies from, like, 20 years ago, you know, where these words are just being thrown out, and it's like, ooh, they just wrote that into the screenplay because they thought that was a normal thing to say, but that doesn't really feel like what it is here.
No, it just, it feels like another sort of layer of the type of violence and frustration that we have seen. And yeah, I think what you're saying is a good point. Like, these kids, these guys know, and, like, when we see him, like, go after Clyde, like, too hard in the car for, like, not smoking weed, and his dad's and whatever, like, and Clyde, like, gets out all frustrated, Rocky gets out and is like, he's an asshole, like, I'm, you know, whatever, like, you can clearly see how this dynamic has been working for many years, and, like, yes, he's a jerk, and, like, yes, but, like, also when he's not being a complete dick, like, they have a lot of fun together. It, again, they're all bored. So there are even, like, one thing that really stood out to me watching is the first scene where we see all three of them together, like, coming down the street. And Rocky is wearing his backpack with the strap, like, around his head. And I was like, that is totally a thing that, yeah, they just, like, brought back
weird,
a thing.
Yeah, it's very, like, a weird thing that seems like the actor probably did it spontaneously in filming it. There was a lot of things in that interaction where he, like, there was a little bit with Rocky sort of joking around about projection and then having to explain what it was that felt very, like, that just seemed like a very real bit of, because he was very, like, awkward about it and he didn't totally seem to get what it was, but trying to explain what it was, it felt like a very real interaction. There's a lot of stuff like that in this movie, that, which is part of why I kind of wonder how much of it was, you know, they just kind of let the actors you know, goof off in character, but maybe not. Maybe it was all written. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a, like, and again, like, that is him sort of, that is Rocky, it would seem, kind of trying to defend Clyde from Marty going a little bit, you know, talking about his dads and stuff. And he tells Marty he's projecting.
Right. That's the thing. His method of defending him is like, no, you're gay. it's not perfect.
It's not perfect, but you can tell that he is genuinely trying. And then he, like, goes and he, like, picks Rory up from school, and the two of them are, like, wandering home across
the
field.
The two of them have a great dynamic, like, a really great brother dynamic that I was very impressed with. You know, I don't know how much time they had to get to know each other before filming or whatever, but it was really good.
It was really good, and it was really, like, again, there's so many of the relationships, particularly in this first, like, two-thirds of the film, that feel so nuanced and feel like you can see so much history in these kids' lives without them having to spell it out in a way that's, like, really impressive. And, yeah, like, just, like, this walk across the field, and they're talking about this kid, and what are they going to do to this kid? And, like, Rocky's, like, throwing his backpack across the field and going to get... And I think that was a thing that really stood out to me, particularly in this first part of the film, is, like, it really felt like kids' mannerisms, like the ways that kids, like, physically move their body and do things that adults don't. Like, and things like the backpack and like various things like are things that like I hadn't thought about. But when I watched it, I was like, yeah, no, that's a thing that a 16-year-old would do. And like why? I don't know. You're fucking bored and just doing shit. And like, and I do think that him and Sam have a really great dynamic in a lot of ways. Like, you can really see how much Sam admires Rocky and stuff. But Rocky is also like a nice kid overall, which I think is like really important. Like, Marty is not really a nice kid because of a lot of trauma reasons, but like Rocky is a nice kid who like hasn't quite figured out like how he's gonna, but like he wants to protect his brother. He also wants to impress Marty and like more of that, but like he wants to impress his brother. He knows this kid. He knows he's a dick. He doesn't think that's fair. Arguably, he might think he can do something about this kid bullying his brother in ways he can't do about like Marty bullying Clyde. Like, there's a lot going on there that probably isn't conscious, but like he is overall like he's a nice kid, and like Sam not only like respects him and admires him as an older brother, but really like he listens to Sam. Like, he hears when Sam tells him.
Well, right, that's part of the thing. You know, he's got this idea, we need to get this kid back for beating you up or whatever. And so he's like pitching ideas for things they can do to him, right? But of course, Sam is like a much more, much younger, and he's like a sensitive kid. He doesn't want to actually hurt anyone. So this is part of like the plan they come up with is they're going to invite him out to this day on the river with them in this old rowboat. And they're going to pretend that Sam really wanted him to come out, and it's Sam's birthday, and they're going to invite him out. And then they're going to, what they said, they were going to like take all his clothes and throw him in the river and then make him get home naked. Like, that was the plan. That was the idea. Like, you know, it's going to teach him a lesson, but it's not actually going to hurt anyone. And the reason why that was what they landed on was because Sam wouldn't agree to anything that would be potentially more harmful. Right. So, and of course they decide to loop this in with Sam's date with Millie, which seems like a really bad idea. I don't know why I suppose this is probably partly, you know, Sam trying to impress Millie because he's, you know, this is what the older kids are doing, and she'll probably be very impressed with this because, yeah, it's... it all makes sense that kids would come to this conclusion that this is how they should do things, but it's like, man... this is poor planning. I wish you had, like, you know, a slightly more mature person around to advise you on some of this.
Well, and this is, like, there are several things here. One, I think that a consistent theme, as we're seeing all of these terrible chess pieces come into place, and, like, the worst possible outcome happens in a lot of ways, but, like, no outcome would have been good, right? Like, I mean, like, you know, Sam, as an 11, 12-year-old, sees this as okay. We're not, like, physically hurting him. But, like, we know as adults watching this movie what an incredibly cruel thing this is to do.
I mean, that's, yeah, even if everything had gone exactly according to plan, this would not have fixed anything. This would have only made everything worse for everyone. You know, they may very well have ended up getting arrested for doing what they were planning on doing alone. And of course, I mean, I guess we should, it's fairly obvious what's going to happen, right? Obviously it's going to go wrong and the kid drowns, even though the you know, more happens. They had mostly decided they weren't going to do it because they all found him, like, once they were kind of around him for longer and heard him talking about himself and his own life, they all kind of found him a little more pitiful than they had before and maybe even liked him a little bit. So they had basically decided not to do it, and then, you know, there's a whole sequence of events, but he ends up falling in the river and drowning, because, of course, you know, that's the way it has to play out in a movie like this, right? Like, that's not some big spoiler. You read the premise of, like, something bad happens, like, oh, one of them drowns. That's obviously what happened.
One of them dies somehow, at least, yeah. No, and I think, but I think that there's a huge undercurrent of, like, that really reads, again, because of how natural these performances feel, in that feeling of kids trying to impress each other, trying to impress the older kids, that, like, constant, like, those power dynamics of, like, wanting to, because, you know, we see it with Marty and his brother, and, like, wanting to be a tough guy with his brother, we see, and his friend, like, and, you know, Sam, I think, is kind of on, like, he is mad at George, and he's mad that he has to be worried about this. There's a line where he specifically is like, the teachers don't care, like, they don't feel like there are any adults in their lives they can go to with this, and, like, But like, I also think he is trying to impress Millie. And part of it is that she says this thing to him when he first is talking to her in the playground or during lunch or whatever, where she's like, if you could snap your fingers right now and he'd be dead, would he? Like, would you do it? And like, I think what Sam heard there, and what was kind of, you know, being hinted at, was this idea of like, you know, yes, he deserves her. So he thought that Millie would be, except, but the thing is that Millie is probably the sweetest of all of them, I guess, and is not really interested in like watching someone be mentally tortured. And the thing is, I don't know if Sam is either, exactly. Like, I don't think that Sam had like thought it through to what it would actually look like.
I don't think, no. I mean, the only reason Sam is doing it is because his brother is pushing for it. Like, I don't think he never would have done any of this on his own, which is part of what, you know, that's part of the dynamic that plays out throughout this movie, is that none of them would have, except maybe Marty, I guess, would have done it. Even Marty, I don't think he wouldn't have done it on his own, because part of his goal is to sort of impress the people around him too, right? None of them would have done any of this on their own, but it's just the combination of personalities that things end up getting pushed a lot farther than they ever would have.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, and to some extent, this is what happens with kids, right? Like, this is, you know, I mean, obviously, most of the time, the bad situation ends up okay, more or less, except when it doesn't. And I think that so I find, like, the last half hour of this movie to be a little long. I wish that we had had, like, perhaps more even of the interactions and less of the after he died. But the first hour of this movie is honestly genius in terms of the acting and the script and what we're seeing there. I have very rarely seen any movie with as like realistic feeling of kids' performances as I have, like, and kids with kids, because it's just them. Like, there's functionally almost no adults. Like, we see adults once or twice, but like, it's basically just them and just trying to figure out.
I mean, the adult we see the most of is Marty's older brother, who is like just a more violent version of Marty, basically. Like, he's a version of Marty that had to take on parenthood at, you know, 17 or whatever. We don't know exactly, but that's the adult that we see the most of. So that's, you know, that's kind of the example the closest example for most of them.
And like, you know, as someone who really loves kids, but also understands, like, you know, their brains aren't there yet. They're not able to conceptualize long-term consequences in the same ways that adults can. And there is also a tendency to feel invincible and to feel like, you know, there's a lot of things playing into this. And again, and like, I do feel like I kind of overstated up boredom. Boredom is playing a lot into this. They don't have a lot to do. They're looking for something to occupy their time. And this is what they choose. And when Rocky calls George, because of course they have Rocky call George, because of course he's going to be the one who is going to be able to convince him, because he is he's a really nice kid and he's really charming. And unlike Marty, doesn't seem to have like Clyde, like he's like this middle ground. Like Clyde, like honestly looks like he was built to be bullied, even if he didn't have two gay dads.
Well, and Clyde had also been bullied by George. That's part of it. Was apparently they had had an encounter at some point where George had hit Clyde in the head with a bat. Like and that comes up later in the movie where George asks him about it. He's like, I was thinking about that and I was trying to remember, what did you do that I hit you in the head with a bat? And Clyde's like, I didn't do anything. I never do anything. And he's like, well, you must have done something. I wouldn't have just attacked you for no reason. Like, because that's obviously how George sees himself. He's always provoked. He's never the one in the wrong. And it's most of them have this sort of history. Really, Marty's the only one who doesn't have like a personal reason to want to go after George until George gives him one, I guess.
Yeah. And I think, and so that, you know, when they have Rocky call and Rocky very charmingly is like, you know, just Sam's, I know you guys have been having trouble, but Sam's always talking about how cool you are. And it's like, you know, on some level you're like, this kid, like, how could this kid possibly believe this? But it's like he wants to, right?
Right. This is the phone call he's been waiting for since he, you know, for as long as he can remember, probably. This is exactly what he's always wanted.
And so, you know, of course he agrees to come out with them. Sam does not tell Millie what they are doing until George is getting into the car, which is shitty. But again, I think he thinks it's going to impress her and he's looking to surprise her. But George... this performance is something else. I really like everything, the clothes, the way that he talks about, like, he has this whole thing where we see him sometimes with just his camera and talking about, like, this is the inside of my mind. And this is such, like, this, like, I just cannot express how accurate this feels to, like, a very certain age group.
Yeah, I see. He's played by Josh Peck, who I am familiar with, but not really. But I guess he was like a star of, was it Drake and Josh? Was that what that show was called?
Something like that. It was a Disney.
He was the star of like a Disney or Nickelodeon show. That so like a lot of people our age kind of grew up with him. My age, I guess. You're a little older. Kind of grew up with him, I guess. I'm not really that familiar, but this is probably a very startling role for a lot of people to see him in. But honestly, at the time, he was probably the best known of these actors, now that I'm thinking about it, even though he's mostly unfamiliar to me. But he's really good. It's so cringy watching him be this person. Like, because he obviously no one wants to be around this kid, like, but it's so sad. He might be the most impressive performance in the movie, I think, which is, I mean, uniformly good, but I think his might be the most impressive to me.
It just feels like such a rough role to inhabit to that level. And like, so I was thinking about this in like my, because, you know, Morgan was like, I feel like Morgan was often hanging out with older kids and was having some of that stuff. But like, to me, I'm like, I am sure, I mean, to some extent, all kids have like some try hard phases and stuff, right? Like that's just part of the deal. You're figuring it out. But I do think that a lot of mine was like pre-junior high or like early junior high. And then I sort of like figured out social dynamics enough. Like I was just, I had some like innate skill with reading a room. And so I started, and I don't remember much of my life before that. So I really don't remember being in the space, at least not where I was aware that I was like that kid. But what I do remember is being in like late junior high and through high school. And I would do anything to not be anywhere near these kids. And I felt bad about it. Like I did feel, because I knew I was, you know, whatever, I was supposed to love people because Jesus or whatever, but like I was working so hard to distance myself from the idea of, like, there was truly absolutely no greater compliment to me than when I told someone I was homeschooled and they were like, I never would have guessed. Like I understood what that meant and I was trying so hard to do that, and I couldn't be around these kids who didn't fucking understand the game you were supposed to be playing or couldn't play it, you know, as the case may be. And like, and I don't think I bullied anyone. Like I don't think I was like actively mean to anyone. Oh, the printer's, I don't know, testing a thing. But I don't think I was ever actively mean to anyone, but I was very definitely like avoidant of, and like in the like pitying nice thing that I definitely see myself in that. I think about certain people that we went to church with, and I'm sure you're thinking of the same people that I'm thinking of, who really struggled socially, frequently because of a lot of trauma reasons and developmental stuff and all of those things. But when you're a kid, what you're aware of is like, again, like they can't conceptualize at this point, like the emotional damage that it will do to this child to do this, because they, like Sam thinks this is a thing that isn't going to physically hurt him. But like, we all know that they would be devastating. Like, and I think they sort of start to realize that as they're like around him and seeing him as like a person. But again, he can't stop undercutting himself. Like even at even Millie, who's like, so who's like the sweetest, will try to be nice to him, and sometimes he like calls her names, and sometimes he like yells at her, tells her to shut up,
shoves his bare foot in her face after telling her he has athlete's foot. That's the kind of thing that he does because he thinks it's going to make everyone else laugh.
Yes. And he, and like, and so, and I think this is part of the really crucial bit is, again, like you said, none of this would happen without all of them, right? And I believe the initial plan was that they were going to go out and they were going to play truth or dare, and they were going to make him strip off all his clothes, and then they were going to, like, that was the plan. And so as they're going out, Sam again goes to Rocky, says, I don't want to do this. This isn't, like, he's sad.
Well, after Millie made him promise to stop it, that was, she was the one who was like, I'm leaving right now if you don't promise me that you're going to put a stop to this.
And and I think he is also feeling uncomfortable about it, you know? So, and so he goes to Rocky and is like, I don't think this is, like, I don't want to do it. And Rocky kind of goes back and forth and knows that he's going to have to be the one to go to Marty, and the Marty's going to be pissed and whatever. And of course, like, Marty's drinking beer the whole way down the thing. And so he's kind of drunk and it's like, you know, hot day or whatever. But Rocky is like, okay, like, if you're, I will talk to Marty. And so he does. He goes and he talks to Marty and he's like, look, I think we want, like, look, this kid is just sad. Like, this isn't, like, and Marty's super pissed. Like, you dragged me out here on a Saturday.
Whatever. And he also does the good Big Brother thing of not being like, Sam doesn't want to do it, so we have to stop. He takes it on himself. Like, I don't think we should do this. I kind of like this kid now. We're not going to do it, rather than trying to do it. You know, like, yeah, I was that was the thing that stuck out to me, is the brother dynamic being very, at this point, like, kind of surprisingly healthy and good.
Yeah, we don't know a lot about Rocky and Sam's family, but they do seem to be kind of the most, like, but yeah, you're right. That's a big deal, especially at that age. And, you know, again, I don't think he's afraid of Marty, but, like, socially is, like, somewhat nervous about what Marty will do, but he's not going to throw Sam under the bus. And I think he's more afraid about what Marty might do to Sam than he is about himself. Yeah. So, you know, he does, and Marty is like, fuck you. Like, what? And it does seem for a minute like maybe they're just gonna have like an okay day with some awkward stuff, but overall nice, and then they're gonna turn around and go home, and that would be a really weird movie, but like honestly I would watch that movie. But
well, and again, he like I think Marty was fully intending on, like, he was gonna push this through, and then there was this moment where he got them all on his side, including Marty. He got them all laughing with him. And I think if he had just sat down in the boat and kept quiet for the rest of the trip, it all would have been fine. But he had to push it because he was going for more, and it didn't go well.
Yeah, and to be clear, I mean, that's not to say it's his fault he died, but it is like where, again, those dynamics are so quick to shift.
Also, part of the thing here is that he doesn't know how to swim, and none of them realize that. I don't think it even occurred to any of them that he wouldn't know how to swim. That's never even mentioned as a factor. So that ends up being that, you know, that he gets pushed into the river and he drowns, and they're all like, why isn't he coming up? What's going on?
Right. And it's seeded a little bit because he's like nervous about them not having life jackets and stuff, but he doesn't want to say we see this repeatedly with him, that he, like, yes, I've smoked cigarettes before. Yes, I've drank before. Yeah. And like Marty will be like, Marty is, like, such an ultimate, like, cool guy. Like, if I had met Marty as a kid, I also would have wanted to impress Marty. Everyone wants to impress Marty. And, like, and, you know, him being like, yeah, I, like, you know, smoked a whole pack of American Spirit menthols. And Marty's like, huh, what if I told you American Spirit didn't make menthols? And, like, it's just, like, needling him, but not enough at that. But we see him consistently, like, lie about shit, which, like, I think most of us did at some point when we were kids. And we definitely knew kids who did it all the time and badly. And, like, and so, whatever. So, but, like, he pisses Marty off. And Marty's like, let's play truth or dare. And there's a lot of back and forth on the boat that, again, like, George doesn't understand and is trying to, like, side with Marty and be like, yeah, these people are all pussies and, like, various things. And, like, finally, Millie gets irritated enough that she's like, no, start the game. And, like, and, you know, like, that's what's good. Like, if she had refused, it is possible they wouldn't have, but she was fucking pissed because he's such an asshole, and she's like, fine, fuck it. Like, I don't, in that moment, she didn't care. And so they start the game and they start doing truth or dare. And, like, for the most part, it's okay. Like, there's a tension that George doesn't understand that is happening, but it's, you know, whatever. They dare Sam to make out with Millie for however many, and he, like, holds their heads together, and I'm like, what a first kiss. But, like, and then, like, Sam dares Marty to, like, show his dick for, this is why I kind of thought that Marty might be 18, but I guess it depends on age of whatever. He makes Millie close her eyes and is like, I don't want to, you know, Marty's not interested in going to jail.
Well, I mean, yeah, I think that, you know, it's not clear how old he is, but even as a 17-year-old, she's 11. I think that would still be, particularly if it ended up on camera, because the kid constantly has his camera out. He told him to put that away, too.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, but again, the kid just pushes it too far, and then Marty, he says something, like, he dares him to jump in the river or whatever, right?
Well, no, what happens, so... the kid unwittingly makes a joke about Marty's dad, forgetting that Marty's dad is dead because he shot himself. He does know that, as we find out a little later, but he forgot it in the moment and he made a joke about Marty's dad, and Marty gets pissed and is like, do not, I'll kill you if you ever talk about my dad again.
We don't know what happened with his dad at that point, except he's not around.
And so then Marty then is like, okay, truth or dare, I'll give you some truth. And he tells the whole plan.
No, because he dares him to do something first. And then George is like, I didn't even pick dare because you didn't ask me. I picked truth. And he says, oh, so you want truth. I'll give you a truth. And then I think he first dares him to jump into the
river.
Yeah,
no, I think you're right. I think he does. I think you're right. Yeah.
But he tells him the whole plan. And of course, George is humiliated. And as we have seen consistently, when he is humiliated, he has no self-control.
Right.
And
total meltdown. He just starts screaming every terrible thing he can think of about all of them, including mocking Marty for his dad having killed himself.
It's a rough scene. He's screaming that, you know, his mom told him that, like, Marty's dad shot himself and splatters brains on the wall. And then he just keeps repeating that, screaming, and everyone's trying to get him to stop and he won't stop. And finally, and like, they're trying to stop Marty from, like, physically going after him, but he ends up getting knocked into the river. Pushed into the river, and again, like Joel said,
Rocky turns and shoves him to shut him up, and he falls in. Yeah,
and again, like Joel said, that they don't know that he can't swim, and he didn't tell them that, and so they think, like, and again, if they were adults, I feel like if I saw someone behaving like that in water, I'd be like, oh fuck, they can't swim. But like, they're just so shocked,
panic mode, like, you know, they're all frozen, right? Because there was this crazy heightened thing that just happened that none of them were expecting to happen, and now there's an emergency happening, and none of them kick into do something about it mode until it's too late, basically.
Well, and honestly, it might have been okay, except that George hit his head on a rock, and so by the time they got to him, you know, they're on a creek, so like the current is taking him away, and so by the time they find him, he's dead in the shallows, and Millie tries to give him CPR. Not the worst movie CPR I've seen, for the record. A lot of times it's really bad. Hers was at least like close to correct. But he's dead, and now they're in a terrible situation where, again, they are all, where particularly Marty is, and I think correctly and understandably in a lot of ways, is viewing this as, this could ruin my entire life. Because he is almost certainly probably the oldest one on that trip. I don't know if he's 18, but he's close. He stole his mom's car to go do this. I guarantee you the cops in that town know who Marty is.
Right, he's probably been arrested before. The boat was also stolen. There's like, one of them is like, yeah, my neighbor has a boat that she never uses. It's just sitting there. We can take it.
Yes, and that was Clyde, which, again, I think is part of why I think Clyde may come from, like, because it's, I don't know, it's nice property out there. But regardless, Marty, and I suspect that Marty's interactions with the law and interactions with all this thing have been very different from some of these other kids. He is not wrong to be concerned that he is going, that like it could ruin his life. The other kids are also not wrong. Like, and I'm not saying that Marty's solution was the right solution. It very clearly was not, but it's very understandable why he's like, absolutely fucking, like, we're going to bury the body. We're not going to do this. Now, it's a terrible idea. It's a terrible idea on so many levels, but it's been a lot of them.
Like, he kind of knows it's a terrible idea too, but he has this whole thing of like, do you have a better idea? You have to go with the best plan you have. Otherwise, you're just stuck and you'll never get anywhere. And this is the best plan that we have, which I don't think is actually the case. Like, it would not be, I don't know. Marty would obviously be the one most likely to get in real trouble, but I don't think it would be that difficult to tell a story to the cops of, we went out on the boat for a day, he fell in by accident, we didn't know he couldn't swim, it's all an accident. Like, I don't think it would be that difficult to sell that story, and probably things would have been fine. But you're not wrong that Marty in particular had reason to worry that it would end up bad for him. And they all had, like I said, Rocky was the one who actually pushed him, and like the boat was Clyde's idea. Like, they all have a factor in this that they could maybe be worried that they would end up being the one, you know, taking the blame or whatever.
Well, and I also think that what Marty says is true. They didn't just go out on the boat. They planned something.
Well, right. I mean, there would have to be a factor of they would all have to agree on a story that was not entirely true. and particularly the younger kids might not hold to that. That's, yeah.
Especially since apparently the cops are fucking interviewing the children with no adults in the goddamn room. At some point, the cop...
get a little bit of that at the end. That was, yeah, that was...
At some point, the cop is like, I have to go get something. And I looked at Morgan and was like, is it an adult to be in the room with this child? No.
Where are this kid's parents? Like,
Jesus. But no, I mean, I think I understand. Because, I mean, that's functionally what he says, right? Is like that once, you know, like, and this is why it partly doesn't like make that much sense, because they are probably going to be, it is very likely that they will, he's counting on them not being called in for questioning at all. And that seems unlikely. People saw them.
Right. I mean, his hope seems to be that, like, you know, this kid will just disappear. No one will know what happened to him. Maybe they'll find him years down the line or whatever. But by then, it'll, you know, we'll all be gone. It'll be fine.
But I do understand the additional, like, I feel like the motivations of these kids feel really clear and all, like, distinctly clear. Like, you can really see where each of them are coming from in a lot of ways. But, like, that feeling of, like, again, like, if we had just gone out for a day on the boat and someone had fallen in and drowned, then yes, of course, we would have, like, whatever. But that's not what happened. We made a plan to do something bad, right, and something worse happened.
They were all feeling guilty already. So it just, yeah, they're all feeling responsible, even though the way it went down, it wasn't really anybody's fault. It was genuinely an accident. Although I guess, you know, if what's his name? I'm forgetting everyone's name again already. The older one had
Marty
get a hold of him, then maybe he would have died not by accident, but. It's, yeah, but they were all already feeling guilty for having planned this whole thing that they had decided not to do, because, yeah.
There's a point where Sam, like, follows Millie kind of into this corner, and Millie turns around sobbing and says, we can never be forgiven for what we've done. And then she just starts repeating, I don't want to be here, which, again, like, felt, like, it just felt really, like, the never be forgiven thing, I was like, yeah, if you grew up around religious stuff, that's probably where you're going, even if you're 11. But, like, also, like, that, like, it just felt so childish, like, so, like, anyway. And then they bury him in, like, the shallowest grave in the fucking world.
Yeah, they did not do a good job with it. Like, I think he probably would have been found within a couple days, but again, they're kids.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter, because they can't live with this. They can't, like, Marty maybe could, not well, I suspect, but the rest of them can't, you know. And Sam, like, goes to Millie and is like, do you, you know, basically, like, what, you know, what do you think? And then they go to Rocky and Clyde, and, like, these are ultimately good kids. And it's not that Marty is, like, a bad kid. He's just a fucked up kid who has a lot of trauma and clearly no one helping him deal with it. And so, like, you know, but these kids have had a rough, you know, I've probably had some levels of a rough life, but not a rough life like Marty has had a rough life. And I think that you see that a lot in those types of groups, is that you get one or two kids who, like, have had a much more abusive and terrible background. And so, like, the perspective is just different on the world, but they seem cool to the other kids because they don't do those things, you know? And, like, they make a wild decision. I thought, I had forgotten they did this. I was like, okay, they're going to go to the cops. No, they're going to go to George's house and tell his mom what they did, which is, wow, not, I think, what I would have done.
Yeah, weird way to handle it. I don't know how they landed on that.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe they thought they had to be forgiven by whatever. And then we kind of see, again, we see them being interviewed by cops. Marty takes off and, like, asks his brother. His brother gives him his gun, and he goes sobbing to rob a supermarket. It's very sad. And, you know, I mean, even if they don't, you know, he's like, I'm going to go to Mexico or whatever. We don't really know where they are. But, like, even...
Yeah, but they're in Oregon. Yeah. They're in rural Oregon. That's where they filmed the whole thing, and I'm pretty sure it says that at some point.
Oh.
They had Oregon placed in the cars and stuff, yeah.
But, you know, Marty's like, I'm going to drive to Mexico. And we all know that even if he gets to Mexico, which probably not, but, like, even if he did, it's not going to go well for him. This is This probably has ruined his entire life, and there are a variety of ways that could play out. Who knows about the rest of the kids? It's certainly going to be a trauma that they never, you know, how awful to have your first date and first kiss be tied up in this. How awful to, like, it's just...
Yeah,
it's,
I don't see a happy ending for Sam and Millie together. That's not going to work.
It's just generally, like, really sad and really tragic, and more so because, again, it's like, these are ultimately good kids. They made some dumb decisions. And the worst possible thing happened out of those dumb decisions. And we see this a lot of times with headline stuff, right? It's like, again, like 9 times out of 10, nothing that alters the course of your entire life happens. But when it does, it's like, look, I get how you got here. Like, I understand, like any number of different decisions could have changed this whole thing. And you're going to be thinking about that for the rest of your life. Like, there's no good answer. Anyway, I do think the end drags a little for me, but like the interaction stuff with the kids and stuff is just so good that I don't begrudge it particularly.
Yeah, I think I agree. I think they kind of spend a lot of time with the decision of what we're going to do about it, and then it feels a little bit like they were, you know, we got to get this to 90 minutes kind of thing, and I don't know that it necessarily needed that, but.
Yeah. So anyway, it's a good movie. Obviously, it's a rough watch. It's up on Amazon Prime. It's easy to access. It is exactly 90 minutes. So, you know, if it's something that sounds kind of up your alley, I would recommend it with the understanding that obviously it is a challenging watch and there are all kinds of reasons why people might not be seeking this one out particularly.
Yeah, but no, it's good. And, you know, it's if you're a person who's always curious about the Culkin's acting career, which I'm one of those people, this is a maybe lesser known early Rory performance. Who I think it's probably fair to say he's the least well known of the three Culkin brothers. But he's done some really good stuff. He's a good actor too. They're all good.
Yeah, no, all that trauma. You know, of the Culkins, I believe we have. Only watched Rory in now two movies, so he has watched a group, so because Signs.
That's right. He was the one in Signs, which this would have been just like a year or two after that, probably. Yeah.
Yeah. Super close. Okay. Well, is there anything else? I looked at the director. He really hasn't done hardly anything else. The writer director.
Yeah. Nothing else that looked interesting. I noticed that as well. He had. Did you notice? This is obviously. Kind of a side thing, but it did stand out to me a little bit that one of his other directing credits is a horror movie called He's Watching, which the premise is a pair of happy-go-lucky siblings left alone while their parents recover from an illness play a series of pranks on each other. The game becomes nightmarish when they realize something sinister is watching them and wants to play too. So like a fairly, you know, fairly standard whatever. But if you look at the cast list, we have Jacob Aaron Estes, who is the director, playing the Red Man and the Clown. That's the name of the character. You have two characters who I assume are the kids, and it appears to be his children because they both have the same last name, listed as playing themselves. You have someone named Gerald Davis, who is listed as the Painter of Pleasure. That's his title. Every character has a weird, like, there's Vincenti the Friendly. This is Letterboxd, so if it's like a long credit, it cuts it off. But there's someone who's credited as the Mouth Monster and the something. I can't see what the rest of it is. The Naked Ram and the Closet. That's one of the characters in this movie. I have no idea. It does like skimming through the reviews. It does not look well regarded or anything. I don't think that just came out last year. But yeah, so I don't know what his deal is. It seems kind of strange.
Huh. Interesting. It almost makes me curious enough to find it. But
I know, right? Like the thing with his kids being billed as playing themselves is very strange in a movie like this. I mean, I assume that they're the two siblings that it... Very strange. I don't know what to think of that. It's weird.
Huh. Anyway. Yeah, I don't know. Is there anything else you want to touch?
No, I don't think so. I think we've covered it.
All right. Well, let's get into it. We are down to 35 movies. So we're making our way through here. So what's next?
What's 34?
34 is The Wind That Shakes the Barley. Here we were just talking about Cillian Murphy.
Oh, yeah. One of his other leading roles. I've been thinking about that movie a lot recently, actually. I don't... For reasons that I couldn't even tell you exactly, but it has come to mind several times recently. I remember being very impressed with that movie. I'm very curious to see it again.
It's a very beautiful movie and very sad. If anyone is thinking about watching it, just as a quick note, it does have some torture scenes in it. And I know for some people that's a hard line, but I watched it several times around that time period. I haven't seen it since, but I remember really being into it.
It doesn't look like it's playing anywhere for free unless you have the AMC Plus, which
I do.
Oh, do you? Okay. Well, it's rentable on, you know, all the usual places. So
cool. Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to that. I think that'll be good. I'm curious to see it again. And I feel like I don't feel like a ton of people talk about it, but I feel like I have heard it come up sometimes over the years and generally positively. Like I feel like, yeah. So yeah. Cool. Well, I don't know. I have a handful of movies. It's honestly overall, I think, been a decent couple weeks for me, in terms of quality of films. But do you want to go first? Do you want me to?
I think you went first last time, so I'll go first this time. I have a handful of things here. So let's see. Doubt was the last one we watched. So the first two that I have. More Mubi stuff. Mubi's had a lot of stuff lately that I've been interested in. They seem to kind of go through phases of like every third movie is something that I really want to see, and then they'll go like a couple months where they don't put up anything that interests me. But they put up a series of movies by a Japanese director named Shinya Tsukamoto. I don't know if you're familiar.
I don't think so.
He is best known for directing a movie called Tetsuo the Iron Man and a couple of sequels for it.
I never saw it, but I remember those titles.
Yeah, it's kind of a... I believe cyberpunk would be the genre that it falls into, but it's kind of like a... It has a little bit of a reputation. It's kind of like extremist body horror kind of stuff. It's about a guy who sort of spontaneously starts growing metal out of his body. And it's all pretty horrifying. I would say it deserves its reputation. It reminded me of the movie Mad God, which I talked about on here. There's like a claymation movie that is just kind of like an 80-minute horror show, but it's not fun to watch. But it's such a mind-blowing technical achievement that you have to kind of admire it. And this movie is absolutely mind-blowing showcase of like makeup effects and practical stuff that I have no idea how they did it. And it's all kind of shot in almost like a music video-y style, which is not my favorite thing. I would say not for me. But it is a very, very impressive movie, and I can understand why a lot of people it definitely has a fan base. Be warned. It is an extremely gruesome movie you might be fine with like watching people get dismembered or whatever. That's a different kind of gruesome. It's a unique kind of gruesome.
I think I'll skip that.
Yeah, I can't imagine that you would get much out of it. At any rate, so they put up three of this guy's movies, and I watched this one, and like I said, it wasn't really for me, but I was kind of like curious enough that I decided to watch another one of them, which is called Bullet Ballet, which is a movie about a guy who he comes home from work one day and finds out that his girlfriend has committed suicide. She shot herself, and this is in Tokyo, where getting a gun is not an easy thing. And he gets like really hung up on this, like, where did she get the gun? And he gets really hung up on this idea of getting another of the same gun, and ends up kind of getting drawn into this crazy like Tokyo underworld stuff. I liked it a little better than Tetsuo. It had a little more to grab onto, but I didn't love it. I don't think there's a third one of his that they have on there that I had kind of thought I might watch, but I probably won't. But he has a very like distinctive and striking visual style. The both movies that I talked about are all black and white. this one, Bullet Ballet, was 98, but it was all, you know, all done in black and white. And like, there's a lot of really cool, like, looking stuff in it, and, but it's not, I don't know. It's not for me. And then another movie thing I watched, Crimes of the Future, which
I saw you didn't like it.
Well, hold on though. Cause this is not the one from last year or the year before or whatever.
Never mind.
Yeah, so I saw that one in the theater and I really liked it. I don't know if you knew this. David Cronenberg released a movie in 1970 that was also called Crimes of the Future.
I did not.
Right. So it was, you know, 1970. This is before he had anything that, like, this. It was very kind of like an experimental. The newer one is not a remake of it or anything. He must have just really liked the title. The only crossover, there is a little bit in this movie that deals with a thing where there's a person who has started growing extraneous organs and no one knows why, which is like a major part of that is one of the driving factors of the plot of the newer one. But yeah, this one, it feels very like kind of student filmy. You can see the Cronenberg in there if you know his stuff. But it didn't hold my attention. Like, it was only 80 minutes long and I was, you know, I found myself not looking at the TV for 20 minutes of it or something. Like, it didn't really work for me. I'm glad I watched it. I always, Cronenberg is one of those directors that I find interesting enough that I just kind of want to watch anything of his that comes up, but, didn't love it. Went to see Joyride. Have you seen that one?
I did. It's also on my list.
I really liked it. I thought it was hilarious. I suspect I probably liked it more than you did.
Yeah, no, I think so. I thought the emotional beats hit really well. Love that we have some non-binary representation. Excellent. Great there.
Deadeye was a great character. Yeah, I really loved Deadeye.
Deadeye was great. And I appreciate that they just kind of like didn't make a thing of it, incidentally. Like, they just very specifically used they pronouns for Deadeye at the end. And like, it's in there, but it's not like a major plot. I like that. But and I thought all the girls were great. Or all the people were great.
I would totally watch a sequel about this same group of people. Like, you know, going somewhere else. Because it has like that sort of like travel movie. They're going to different places and stuff. And I was really into it the whole way through. I thought almost all of it was really funny. There were a couple of things. I didn't really think the whole thing of them pretending to be a K-pop group. I didn't think that whole...
Oh, I thought that was funnier than the drugs.
That's fair. The drug thing, I think, was probably a little bit overplayed. But overall, I was really into it. I thought it was really funny.
I thought it was fine for the first hour. Like, I don't think I actually laughed out loud at any point. I thought the third act where they landed, I thought they really landed the emotional beats in the third act. But it was a bit of a mixed bag for me overall. But I mean, you know, I'm glad I went to go see it. I would totally watch more movies by these. Like, it felt a little at times like there was a, I can't remember who, it might have been Scott Tobias that I was reading his review of it, where he was talking about like, it feels a little bit like there's this pressure to, like, you have, if you're making a comedy like this, there are things you have to include. And like, he was talking about like Bridesmaids, for example, and how what's her face, who made Kristen Wiig, who has talked about how like the vomiting scene was like not something she wanted to do. It was not part of her original thing. But the studio said she had to put it in for the type of movie she was making. And Scott, I think it was Scott Tobias, was talking about how like he felt a little bit of that in Joyride. Like, there were certain things that they just felt like they had to add. I think I agree with that. But like I said, the last third really, really worked for me. And I definitely would watch these characters and more things. So.
Yeah, I'm definitely glad it exists. It's a fun movie. So I watched, still catching up with Mission Impossible movies. I watched Rogue Nation and Fallout, which obviously you've also, I don't remember which one you got to last time, but.
Last time I had watched Rogue Nation, we watched Fallout and Dead Reckoning Part 1 on the same day.
Gotcha. I still have not seen Dead Reckoning Part 1. That's later today. But they did, I had, the Rogue Nation and Fallout are like direct sequels to each other in a way that they hadn't done in the franchise previously. Like, they have the same villain, right? There's like a direct tie over of the plot. I think Fallout is sublime. Like, everything about that movie works amazingly well. It's one of the best action movies to come out in my lifetime. I think
that's wild.
I mean, I'm hardly alone in this opinion. You're the one in the minority. But I really love the character of Ilsa Faust, who they brought in Rogue Nation.
I do like Ilsa, for the record.
And Rebecca Ferguson, who plays her, is just like, she's one of the great, like, sort of new talents of the last decade, I think. And
she's great.
She takes on the physical stuff in this with, you know, every bit as much like gusto as Cruz does, although obviously she doesn't get to do the large scale stunt work. But she does the, you know, the fight scenes and all that so well. The character is really interesting in a way that I would say the sort of side characters in the franchise had not been previously. And then in Fallout, you get the whole, like, obviously the jump from the plane is probably the, maybe not quite as mind-blowing as the climbing on the outside of the Burj Khalifa scene from the fourth one, but it's up there. It's pretty fucking incredible. And, like, the bathroom fight scene is one of the better examples of that kind of thing I've ever seen. It's all so good. It's just so good.
So here's the thing. I had forgotten. I thought I had seen all of them up to this point, but that's not correct. I had watched through. I didn't watch the last
Fallout. Okay.
I hadn't seen Fallout. So that was new. That was the first time I had watched it. It was fine. I have a lot of, like, I just, like, at the end of the day, I fucking hate him. He's a terrible fucking person. I despise him. And I don't know how to, like, get over that. Like, if I'm, like, I know that you hate the Fast and Furious movies, but, like, a big part of, like, why I like the Fast and Furious, and don't get me wrong, Vin Diesel is also an asshole, but not like Tom Cruise is an asshole.
There are not a lot there aren't a lot of people that we know are as bad of people as we know Tom Cruise is. There may be other people who are that level of bad, but there aren't a lot of them that we that are that publicly that bad.
Exactly. So, like, Vin Diesel is, like, a fucking petulant child, and it's stupid and annoying. It absolutely is. But I like the characters in Fast and the Furious, and I have fun watching them on screen. And there has never been a millisecond where I have fun watching Tom Cruise on screen. Like, I am constantly just desperately searching for the people around him who I am remotely interested in. And I do kind of enjoy Simon Pegg, and I think Ving Rhames is always, like, a great present. Ving Rhames, right? Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, I don't know if it's Rames or Rams, actually, but yeah.
Him. He's a great presence always on screen. I like his voice. I like hearing him talk. I do think Ilsa is good. Like, but I am just constantly scrambling for scraps that will make up for the fact that I have to watch Tom Cruise fucking run for 20 minutes at a time. Like, and I just don't know how to get past that, and I don't think I can.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's I would say on the list of reasons to dislike the Mission Impossible movies, that's probably one of the more valid ones. But he still works for me as a movie star in spite of what I know about him as a person. I have been very uncomfortable with all of the sort of adoration heaped on him by film people over the last couple of years as, you know, the guy who's saving the theater going experience, even if it may be accurate, it may be. I would like to not see that kind of sort of uncritical praise heaped on him.
But I did like at the end of Fallout. I did find the helicopter chase very funny. I laughed a lot.
I mean, it is funny, but it's also like, holy shit, this is so cool. That's how it plays for me.
I mostly laughed a lot.
The idea that you're gonna ram a helicopter into another helicopter in order to catch a guy that's in the it's ridiculous, but it also all looks very impressive.
I will say that it reminded me. It's the only time I can think of where I have seen an action movie scene and was like, this reminds me of Star Wars. because the chasing through the snow and the shooting, like, it looks kind of like a Star Wars chase with, like, the lasers shooting. I don't know. Anyway, but I liked sort of the presumably goodbye that we got with Michelle Monaghan, and I liked Ilsa, and, like, I liked that vibe because I'm always looking for, and this is something that happens at least once in Fast and the Furious, of it not being like a weird cat fight or not be, but, like, being a thing of, like, we both love this person, and, like, this is how, like, I like that in general in things. I will say, I know that you find Tom Cruise and Michelle Monaghan to have great chemistry. I do not feel like Tom Cruise has ever had chemistry with anyone in his entire, not sexual chemistry, at least.
I actually, I don't know that I would say that necessarily, because I think what I, when I talked about the third one, I did think some of the, like, the weak point of that movie is the sort of love story between the two of them, which is carrying, like, the emotional weight of the movie, and I don't think totally works. And I actually want to, I do really like the fact that they brought her back the way they did in this movie, because I felt like it kind of, like, I think it's probably overstating it to say redeemed her character, but I think it gave her a much more interesting dynamic than she had in the third one, and gave her kind of her own, you know, her own character and her own, you know, she's a, her own thinking being who is participating in events rather than being the, oh, okay, you go do your thing. She participated in things at the end of the third one too, but it was because she got kidnapped. Like, it wasn't. At any rate, I really like the way they brought her back for this one. I don't know if she's going to show up again, but
I did like that. I agree with Eric that mostly I have never for even a millisecond felt like Tom Cruise was in love with anyone other than himself. And so it is, like, wild to me when I'm, like, watching these movies and I'm supposed to, like, see. I mean, it's similar to Bond in a lot of ways where I'm just, I mean, I don't hate all of the Bond actors in the same way, but, like, where I'm like, okay, I get wanting to fuck him, but, like, I'm supposed to believe that you're in love with him? Like, I really struggle to, like, pull that. And I know that's not, like, the key part. But again, when I'm constantly just, like, looking for scraps on characters that I can, like, enjoy watching for, like, some period of time, it's, like, a thing that gets me. Anyway, whatever. I am curious to have a conversation after you've seen Dead Reckoning, and I am curious what you'll think of it.
I'm very excited, and I've seen people talking on Twitter that this one has gotten a little bit more of a divisive response, it seems. So I've managed to avoid spoilers. I don't know why. So I'm excited. I'm looking forward to it.
I'm doing a great job not giving them, and maybe we will have that conversation on air, but realistically, probably not, because the movie will have just come out.
Yeah, it'll be recent enough. We probably won't want to do that. Anyway, I got a couple more things here. I watched School of Rock the other night, which I hadn't seen in years.
I still haven't seen it.
You've never seen it? It's so much fun. Like, I mean, it's, you know, I really like Richard Linklater as a director. I think most of his stuff is really good. And this is, like, the, you know, people that he has, like, a few different distinct modes as a director, where he does, like, the Before movies and Boyhood and stuff like that. And then he has, like, his weird trippy stoner movies. He's done a few of those. And then he also does, like, these sort of, like, straight across the plate, like, you know, broad audience comedies. And he's really good at all of those things. Like, it really is. I think he's underrated, might not be fair, but I think he's maybe underappreciated as a director. But at any rate, and it's one of the Jack Black's more fun roles that I've seen. He's really kind of carrying, because obviously it's him and the cast of kids for the most part who have kind of mixed abilities in terms of their acting. And, like, it really is Jack Black and to some degree Joan Cusack, who's also in it. I know you really like Joan Cusack. So they're kind of, it's mostly Jack Black kind of carrying the whole thing. But he's, you know, he just has that, like, enthusiasm. He just seems to be having the time of his life. It's so fun to watch.
No, I mean, it's a gap. It's a significant gap for me. The reasoning is just that I didn't like Jack Black when the movie came out, and now I don't feel that way. But, like, at the time, I didn't go see things with him most of the time if I could help it. Like, my primary association with Jack Black when I was younger was, like, Shallow Hal and stuff.
I was going to say, I think most of what he was doing at that time you probably would still hate, and I would probably still hate. Like, you know, he kind of got pigeonholed into the, like, the fat funny guy thing for a while, which, I mean, I guess that's he's found a better version of that now, I think. But yeah,
no, and I love, he seems to be living his best life. I love his TikToks. He seems to be having a great time, and I do genuinely love him now. I just never got back to it. We were literally just talking about it, like, last weekend, because Mel was like, we should watch School of Rock, and we just, like, didn't get to it. But sooner or later I will get to it. I do want to see it. It does feel like a significant gap in my, like, movies. Yeah,
it was one of those I hadn't seen it in years, and I was quite relieved that I still enjoyed it as much as I did. It's a blast. And then, so last night they're doing the outdoor movies again in Fairhaven. They do them every summer. And last night they did Mamma Mia. So May and I went to see that. I had seen it once before. We watched it. May and I watched it before we did our trip to Greece several years ago, but I hadn't seen it since. And I, you know, seeing it, it like, you know, projected onto the side of a building with a whole crowd of people is kind of the perfect way to see it. It was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it has its flaw. The direction continues to baffle me. It's a very weirdly directed musical. It's as if he had never seen a musical before. But honestly, for me, it just seems like the entire cast is having such a good fucking time. And these are all people that I want to watch have a good time.
Right, so, like, and it's a lot of people who, like, I would never have expected that they would want to do something this goofy, right? It's people that you don't see doing that kind of stuff. So
I still maintain their worst choice was having Pierce Brosnan do his own singing, because it is absolutely unlistenable.
Especially since his character has by far the most singing of the three male leads. And Skarsgård isn't a very good singer either.
And neither is Colin Firth.
He's not very good, but he's better than the other two. But yeah, it was a weird choice, because he has like three songs where he's like the lead, and it's bad.
I have never heard someone less able to carry a tune in a professional production, and like, and you know, those had to be the best takes. So like, it's physically painful for me to listen to it. There's a cat sitting outside the window. It is physically painful for me to listen to it, and honestly, that is like my major complaint with the movie, because it's just so. But like, Meryl Streep, Christine Baranski, love of my entire fucking life. Like, Does Your Mama Know That You're Out is like. Incredible.
I had completely forgotten about that scene, and that was great. Yeah.
It's just, it's so much fun. It's just such a fun fucking movie. And like, I think, you know, it, in spite of some baffling directing choices and a lot of like close ups on dance scenes that clearly should not be, and like weird shit like that.
Well, I think a lot of it was like, I think they filmed like most of the, they filmed a lot of stuff actually on a Greek island somewhere, but I think all of the like, the interior and like courtyards in the hotel and stuff were all done in a studio, I think. So there's a lot of like the every time they go outside, it's like sunlight and, you know, sort of naturalistic. But then there's all this stuff where they're in like the courtyard of the hotel where they're supposed to be outside, but it looks like a soap opera with the lighting. So there's, you know, there's things like that, that are a little bit jarring, but it's, you know, it's a fun enough movie that it doesn't really matter that much. Just honestly, just watching Meryl Streep have that much fun is like, because she does not get to do a lot of comedy. She's usually suffering in some way in her movies. I mean, obviously we just talked about Doubt last episode. But, and again, like it would not really have occurred to me that she had that in her, even though like, obviously, like I don't really believe there's anything Meryl Streep can't do, but it still wouldn't have occurred to me that like, yeah, she can do the like, dance number where she's bouncing on the bed because she's so happy. Like,
no, I have watched Mamma Mia many times in my life, and it's like watching the level of pure joy that Meryl Streep exudes being in that movie is just like, it's just in like between her and Christine Baranski and goddamn it, what is the other one's name? She was in Harry Potter. She was Mrs. Weasley.
Julie Walters.
Yes, Julie Walters, who I also love. Like, it's just like it, and again, it's women of like a certain age that you often don't get to see, and like, you know, and it's just, it's so good. Amanda Seyfried is great. Have you watched the sequel yet? Because it is also good.
I haven't. I was actually kind of wondering about that. I don't know what the sequel's about, but do they reuse the same songs, or do they have to go like real deep into the? Because I feel like they used all the big ones for the first movie. I don't know how they.
It's other ABBA songs, and it is, they mostly fix the Pierce Brosnan thing because the majority of the movie takes place when Meryl Streep and him, it's that summer. Back to that summer. And I can't remember the girl's name who plays young Christine Baranski, but she is chef's kiss perfection, everything you would want to play young Christine Baranski. And all of the men who are playing the younger versions of the men can actually sing. So that's nice. but it's fun. I liked it a lot. I didn't remember that you had enjoyed the first one. So
it looks like Lily James played young Donna, which is
yeah.
And let me. I'm curious, so I'm gonna look. Tanya is Christine Baranski's character.
Yes.
Jessica Keenan Wynn, who I've never heard of, and she only has a couple other credits, so I don't know.
I would suspect she's more of a stage actor. I thought that might be true with a lot of them. Not all of them, but a number of them. Anyway, it's really fun, though. I think it's worth watching if you enjoy the first one, which it sounds like you did. So,
Yeah, we may get around to it at some point because yeah, we both really enjoy that one. That's all I have for movies. Have you watched season 2 of The Bear yet?
We are halfway through. We have watched 5 episodes. We watched 5 episodes on Thursday. It was incredible.
So you haven't watched the Fishes episode yet?
No.
Okay. Well, we'll have to wait to talk more about that then.
But I do think the second season is even better than the first one at this point. I don't think it's like necessary. I think it's just that the first season required a lot of building of these characters. And in the second season, because we already have so much background, we're able to like dive into things a little bit deeper.
I ended up with like a little bit of a quibble about the second season that we'll wait till you finish it to get into it, but okay. It's minor. I still really love it. Other than that, I don't think I have any other TV to talk about unless I might be forgetting something, but nothing else comes to mind. So I think I'm done.
Okay. Well, the day after or the day of, I don't know, day after we recorded last time. I don't know. No, Dave. We went to go see Asteroid City. Look, here's the thing. I want to understand Wes Anderson. I do. I don't like it when I don't understand major directors. It's not a thing that I enjoy. And this one, I felt like, the way I described it to Morgan when we left, is that I felt like I could see that there was a lot emotionally going on under the surface, like so much. I could see that. But it was like it was through a pane of glass, and I could not experience any of those emotions whatsoever. And so, like, I felt like I could, like, in some ways, I felt watching it, like, I did understand something a little more. Like, I was able to, like, see sort of some of the deep-seated emotions that he was working with in ways that I cannot always at all see in his movies. But I still, it just doesn't make any emotional sense to me at all. I don't get it. I just don't. And I'm going to keep trying because I've watched them all and I'll keep doing it. But I liked it certainly better than the last one, whatever that was called.
French Dispatch.
Certainly better than French. Like, I liked it better than I have liked, I think, the last couple of Wes Anderson films. But I just felt like if I could just figure out like a hook to get me there, and I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't find it. So, like, it's a good movie. Obviously, it looks beautiful. That kind of goes without saying. It was certainly the most diverse of his movies that he's done so far. So that's nice, I guess. But yeah, it just. Anyway, and then we came home, and Criterion has a collection of Elvis movies up right now. So
yeah, no, I've seen they've been advertising that. Yeah.
So we watched Jailhouse Rock. I had a good time watching. I had a better time watching it than Morgan. It's just like it's a very weird, like of an era sort of thing, and it was fun. Like whatever. And then I was like, okay. Like, what's a random thing we can watch? Let's watch the Tetris movie. So I'm going to make a list of it at some point on Letterboxd. I haven't yet, but the Products Cinematic Universe. Like, so we started with Tetris just kind of randomly. I don't know. It was just like the first one that came to mind. It was very fucking boring. I really do like Taron Egerton, and he was doing his best, man. But like, there was it felt like everything I hate about biopics. In just like, it just felt like it was a true story, and they're just like checking boxes in this weird way. There was nothing that interesting. Like, it's kind of an interesting story, but like, you didn't really justify to me why you needed to make it a movie. Honestly, like, I would read like a New Yorker article about it. I don't really need to see a movie. So whatever, that was whatever. And then the next day, we went to go see Past Lives. I cannot say yet because it is only July, but it is very probable this will end up being my favorite movie of the year. I cried so hard. I remember like halfway through the movie, I was like, Joel said there was a scene with a cut. I haven't seen it yet. I did see it.
You saw it, right?
Sure fucking did. And I did gasp out loud and start crying harder. And just, what a fucking movie. What a fucking movie. Absolutely so beautiful. So just, oh my God, I loved it so much, and I think I can't wait to watch it again. If it is not my number one of the year, then this is going to be a really good year. It's going to podcast.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a few things coming out that I know about that I'm fully expecting to like make my top five or whatever, and it could be, you know, they could shift around a little bit, but it's definitely going to be up there.
I don't see any possibility that it is not at minimum in my top three. Like, even if we have, you know, like if something is better than that, it's going to have to be like drive my car levels that I am convinced is going to be changing my life for the next like 3 decades, which this could also land there. I don't know yet. But like, yeah. So we watched that. So then we came home that night and I was like, well, Tetris was kind of a bust. A few days later, I guess. Tetris is kind of a bust, but let's try the next one. And I had seen a TikTok where someone was talking about Pinball, the man who saved the game. This movie is going to end up in my top 10 of the year, Joel. It's so fun.
I don't think I've even heard of this. Is this a documentary or is this... No? Huh, this is the first I've heard
of. It is one of the best biopics I have ever seen. It is like everything that Tetris did badly, this movie did well. It was like... It's so... Did you know that pinball was illegal in most of the country for a very long period of time because they considered it a gambling...
Yeah, it was a gambling thing. Yeah, I did know that. Yeah.
So the main character in this, and we... God, I don't even want to spoil how it's done. I think you really should watch it. I think you'll love it.
Who's in it? I know nothing about this movie. I'm flabbergasted here. I've never heard of this. Is this a new, like a recent movie? It just came out
this year. So honestly, a lot of the people in it, I didn't know them very well. The guy, Dennis Boutsikaris, who has definitely been in things and I have definitely seen him over time. I have never seen him in a role like this. But it's honestly, it's not really anyone. It's the first director's credit of Austin Bragg and Meredith Bragg, I think, are the first major film credit, who I think are, I don't know if they're married or siblings, but.
Oh, it's Mike Feist.
Oh, yes. Also Mike Feist.
He was in West Side Story. He got a Oscar nomination for West Side Story, which
right.
That was the first thing I had ever seen him in, but I was very impressed by him in that. So that, okay.
It is, so the main character is a guy who had a major, who ended up having a major part in overturning New York City's ban on pinball, which ended up sort of like shifting to the rest of the country over time. And he is such, I laughed, I cried. He is such a, like, he's such a remarkably charismatic, nice, like, it's really good, Joel. I think you would really like it.
Where is it? What's the showing on?
I believe we had to rent it, and it was, I mean, I think, well,
what? It's not even, like, a streaming movie? I've seen so many things about, like, this weird trend of movies about products and stuff, and I've never heard of this movie.
We had to rent it on Amazon. It's really good, though. Like, if you guys are looking for, like, a fun movie some night that is just, like, a really good time and really genuinely sweet at core, like, this is it, man. It's fucking great. So, anyway, so then Friday, or this would have been not this Friday, last Friday, but the one before, I went down to see Eric, and Eric was like, have you watched Nimona? Have you heard of Nimona yet?
I like the lung... Get fluid in your lungs?
No. Eric.
Oh, is this an animated thing? Okay, I've seen some stuff about that on Twitter. I think Guillermo del Toro's been tweeting about it a lot.
So Eric's niece and nephew had been really pushing for him to watch it. And it's gay. It's great. It's really great. Beautiful, beautiful movie. So beautifully done. Very sweet. Very funny. A great time. Again, another one that's just really great to watch if you're just looking.
That's a Netflix one, right?
Yes, that is enough.
I think that was the one that, like, it almost got, it got caught up in one of those, like, studio buyout things, and it got dropped, and it wasn't going to come out, and then it was like a whole story, they had to find another distributor for it or something.
Well, I'm glad they did, because it's genuinely very, very good. And then we went to go see Joyride, and we've already talked about that, and then we went to go see the Mission Impossibles, and we've already talked about those as much as we're gonna. So that's all of my movies. For TV, we've watched the first half of season 2 of The Bear. Morgan and I started, well, I've seen the first season of Only Murders in the Building, but Morgan hasn't, and the third season is coming out. So we started watching that. We're also planning on rewatching for me, Reservation Dogs, because that's also coming out in a few weeks. And we also watched through Good Omens, which Morgan hadn't seen. And that one is also coming out in a few weeks, season 2. I was delighted. Like, you know, when that show came out, I think I binged the whole thing in like 2 days. That was several years ago. I was like, am I still going to? But no, it's fucking great. It's a delightful, delightful experience. I don't know. We've been watching The Righteous Gemstones.
Oh, yeah. I forgot that had come back. I haven't decided yet if I'm going to. I enjoyed the first two seasons, but it was always like, it was a little bit up and down for me, and I don't know if I'm going to keep going with it. I don't get the sort of adoration that a lot of people have for what's his name and his comedy. I don't.
Yeah, I can't remember his name either, but no, I don't. Mm.
Yeah, like I like that show better than any of the other stuff I've seen with him, but I don't. There's a lot of people who think he's like the American comedic genius working right now or whatever, and I don't get it.
And we finished Fatal Attraction, which was indeed unforgivably bad by the end. But we did do that. And still watching Secret Invasion, which is fine. It's not great. I wouldn't necessarily.
Yeah, I saw there was a big plot reveal about that would have everyone would have cared about a few years ago. No, it seems like it's just kind of the punchline to a joke. I have not been watching it. I don't think I'm going to.
Honestly, fair decision. It's, yeah, like the stuff that is most interesting, the show doesn't seem to be that interesting. It's just whatever. So yeah, I think that's mostly it. But I will say, I mean, I didn't watch a ton of movies the last few weeks, but I had a lot of really good ones that may end up in my top 10 of the year. So like, that's cool. That was nice. I felt like I hadn't had like a couple weeks lately where I was like, oh shit, movies are great.
Well, yeah, we're getting into it here. Next time we record, we will have both seen Barbie and Oppenheimer, presumably. So we're big things happening.
Big things. So yeah, excited about that. But yes, next time we will talk about The Wind That Shakes the Barley, and yeah, that'll be good.
Yeah, it'll be a very Cillian Murphy heavy episode next week.
That's true. All right, everyone. We'll see you in a few weeks. Bye.
Bye, everyone.